This is Revolutionizing Recruitment with Kathleen Duffy, the arts of attracting, acquiring, and retaining talent. Here's Kathleen.
My guest this week is Johnny Taylor Jr., the president and CEO of the Society of Human Resource Management. SHRM is the largest HR professional association in the world with over 300,000 members in 165 countries. Johnny is also the author of the new book, Reset, A Leader's Guide to Work in an Age of Upheaval. Johnny, welcome to the podcast.
So glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, I have to kick things off by just congratulating you on your book, Reset. And it's a number one bestseller on Amazon in the workplace culture list. High five. But I saw on LinkedIn yesterday, it's a Wall Street Journal bestseller too.
You know, I'm just amazed by it. You know, you write these things because they're your thoughts and you'd like to think that other people will think they're valuable enough to go pick up online or something. But if not, that's okay too. And I'm just astonished at the receptiveness in the market. So thank you for inviting me to talk about it today.
You bet. Well, I have to tell you, there were just so many great takeaways in the book. I really felt that you wrote it just for me personally. So So thank you very much. But let's talk about, you know, why was it important to write this book now?
Well, so here's the deal. If you all think back to where we were, Friday the 13th, I like to say, it was Friday, March the 13th, 2020. That was the day when the White House and everyone essentially said, this is a real problem. But what they said to us at the time was, and this really tells you how I wrote the book, they said, we're going to have, you know, 14, 21, 30 days, everyone hunkers down and we don't travel, we don't do anything, and this disease will be resolved, right? And so I really started writing what I was going to call the Great Pause, because I thought for the first time in our lives, we're going to have a 30-day period where we all sit down, we stop, we pause. And I said, I want to chronicle this. So that's really what I started writing. And then by the 90th day and then the 180th day, and frankly, here we are today, still not in a post-pandemic world, I began to realize that my chronicling of 30 days was going to turn into a book. And it wasn't going to be about a pause, instead a reset. Unlike when you hit the pause button, you pick up where you left off. In a reset, you start all over.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's funny. I was thinking about that when you said Friday the 13th. I was actually at a fundraiser event and Janet Napolitano was speaking.
Yes.
And we didn't really know what to do. Like, did we fist bump? Did we kick? It was the beginning of the awkward in-person meetings, right, that we have now.
Oh, gosh. Let me tell you. And later I'm going to tell you about that. But it's really fascinating because that alone, that question about the handshake versus the fist bump versus the elbow tap, I mean, all of this is just absolutely fascinating when you think about the reset of our entire human experience.
Absolutely. You know, the book has, I felt it was a really great playbook and it identified several workforce issues. But of course, the one I want to focus on is recruitment.
Yes.
In chapter 5, Finding and Keeping Great Talent, you say, your biggest challenge isn't technology, innovation, or even leadership. It's finding, hiring, and engaging the right talent to thrive now and in the future. And to do this, you must have cultural alignment between the employer and the candidate. So, Johnny, what I'd like to know is, what are your go-to questions to assess cultural alignment?
So, wow, one of the best questions ever. I've never been quite asked that, but I'm going to tell you what I ask. And listen, the answer is going to differ by person because it depends upon what your culture is. So, for example, within SHRM, one of our really important cultural characteristics and guiding principles is one that speaks to people who are smart and curious. And so one of the questions I automatically ask someone is I throw them off. Tell me about something that you really are curious about that has nothing to do with this job. I'm really trying to understand, is the individual genuinely curious? Because listen, all of us are subject matter experts at something, presumably, and that's the job for which you're applying. And so you come into the interview expecting to be asked questions if you're a finance person about finance and accounting, if you're a lawyer about X, Y, and Z. But I say, tell me something that has nothing to do with your job, because I really want to know, what are you curious about? And it's not with judgment. I don't care what your opinion is about it. I just want to know, because really smart people are curious about a whole bunch of things, and I want to know what that is. So I ask that question, and listen, if I have someone who's technically really talented but can't give me a decent answer to that, then I decide they're not really aligned with us, because we want people who are curious about things. So we think that's how you innovate. You ideate in sessions, and so that's an important characteristic. One of the others, though, that I ask a lot about is, what does diversity mean to you? It's a big question for me, because when we talk in this world, when everyone, you know, automatically you pivot to your, if it's a woman, it's gender issues, if it's black, it's race issues. I mean, it could be, but I'm curious about people's real commitment to diversity. Because diversity isn't just diversity when you agree with someone. In fact, by definition, it means different. So do you have the appetite to come into an organization where people can, reasonable minds can disagree? And then the questions, the follow-up questions are, and what do you do when you run into someone who sees the world differently than you? How do you approach it? How do you respond to this difference, et cetera? Because I'm trying to figure out, at the end of the day, will you be able to work in a culture that absolutely celebrates true diversity?
Excellent questions. I think I'm going to add the curious one to our process as well. So my next thing is about our lovely talent acquisition leaders and those that are really strategic and trying to move the agenda forward, but they work for data-driven CEOs.
Yes.
And how can they help these CEOs determine if their company culture needs a reset?
So I find that, listen, I'm one of those data-driven CEOs, but data is not dispositive. It's informative, right? It informs my decision. And so when I was a CHRO and talent acquisition was a part of our remit, I had a CEO. Listen, I worked for Barry Diller, and I talk about it in the book. Mm-hmm. And you want to talk about one who's very, very data-driven and opinionated. And so I knew that when I came in to make the case about culture, a word at that time, you're talking the 90s, was such a soft word. It was such an, mm-hmm. An HR word. He didn't want to hear about that, you know? So I had to meet him where he was. And so I said, you know, oftentimes, Barry, and this was the big, you know, when millennials were beginning to come into the workforce. I can't believe millennials, by the way, are 40 years old this year. 1981 was when they were born, right? But in any event, I would go in and I'd say, you know, this new generation of workers, they really, really, really are curious about culture, Barry. And if we want the best and brightest people, it's not going to be enough to just offer them a lot of money. They have a different value set. And I would then show him the data, show him interviews with candidates, show him and say, this is the dilemma. We are not going to be able to get the best and the brightest. That moved him more than me going in and delivering a kumbaya message and people want to be heard and seen and it's the right thing to do. I basically couched it as a talent acquisition professional in the context of, we're going to lose the talent game. Mm-hmm. The other companies are going to get the people you want, because when it's Google, when it's Apple, when these are your competitors, we're in the tech space, they can pay the same thing you can pay. So you can't mm-hmm. outpay them for the talent they want. This is going to come down to culture. And the data tells us that culture matters to this talent.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that was the beginning of the foosball table.
Absolutely. You remember, and like, you know, a foosball and ping pong tables and free food and all of that. Now, fascinatingly so, we're learning that was an overly simplified definition of culture. You're right. Mm-hmm. Everyone thought, throw in all of these things, hyperbolic chambers where people can go breathe free air when they're stressed, those sorts of things, all cute. And they were, I call that web sort of 1.0 or 2.0 when it comes to culture. And now we've gotten a lot more advanced about what people really mean when they talk about culture.
Yeah, I think we're asking them instead of trying to like read their mind or, you know, so I think we're starting to do a better job of asking them.
Yes.
You talk about the Culture Club when you were over at Interactive Corporation.
Yes.
Can you tell us what this Culture Club is?
So the Culture Club is an idea. You pick a random, and I, by the way, have brought it with me here at SHRM as well, but the idea that you bring together a cross-sampling, a diverse population of your employees, and I'm talking diverse in all of the various dimensions, tenure, rank with the institution, of course, the civil rights diversity, gender, age diversity, and all of our business units. We had 18 to 20 different business units, from ShoeBuy to Home Shopping Network to Ask.com, Match.com, and we had a lot of business units. So the whole idea was to really, when you talk about that data word, to get the pulse of the employees in a way that was different than a typical survey, an employee survey, you know, satisfaction or engagement survey. We could actually get qualitative information drilled down when someone said, the culture's not good here. And we said, well, what does that mean? And not in a 20-question survey, because we wanted to go deeper. And we did that and really kept our fingers on the pulse of the organization. It was as much about something you just said. We actually began asking employees, what does culture mean to you? Versus assuming what we knew or how we define culture as the executives of the organization. And so it was very, very helpful. And I've taken it with me into my world here at SHRM.
Well, I like in the book that you mentioned that there was a leader who saw an innovative gene in you. Yes. And they asked you to join that group. So what did they see in you, Johnny?
You know,
at that time, the Johnny of that time.
Right. He was a mess, I can tell you. But no, I can now look back and say, my 30-year-old self was. No, it's this idea that I was not happy with the current state of anything. And so I was like, how can we make a better wheel? How can we make a better? And I constantly asked those questions. Now, I didn't do that to the point where I spent all day questioning stuff and getting nothing done. You've got to live in the reality, but you've got to constantly be thinking about the future. And I'm naturally curious. Thus the question about curiosity. Like, how can we make this different, better, faster, cheaper, like whatever we can do. And I would constantly ask those questions, even as a lawyer. And so you may say, well, you know, I wasn't in a marketing group. I wasn't in a tech group. I was a lawyer, but I was constantly thinking about ways to innovate, to be better at what we did as an organization, even in the law department. And a lot of people saw that, which was, it's such a blessing. I thought I was just being a pain in the ass, you know, but but the key was I asked these questions, but I also did the work.
So how do you advise or suggest or coach, mentor, whatever, leaders to find and even see that innovative gene on their teams? That's kind of a gift.
Well, it's a gift, but it's one of those things that I absolutely believe you can become good at as a leader. So, you know, there's always a question of nurture versus nature, whether leaders are made or whether they can be developed. What, when it comes to this funny thing about this whole idea of identifying talent, we can all get much, much better at it. It includes overcoming some of our own biases. And by the way, every one of us, every individual on earth has a bias or two or three or four. And so overcoming that, but this whole notion of training people to look for innovation and not to squelch it, not to shut it down, is really, really hard, but doable. Because we as business leaders, and you know the story, you're busy trying to get stuff done. So you typically are like, I don't have time to have this person who's over here tinkering. That is not solving my current problem. What we've done is taught people managers to embrace that person. That is a part of your culture. Reward them. And that means you're also going to reward some of their failures. And Google, I think it was Google, that would give people time during the day to just go off and think. That's where the best innovations would come from. It doesn't necessarily cost you a lot of money. And it's not that people are wasting time. They're actually something, the best ideas will come out of someone who can step away from doing during the day and thinking during the day. So it's really encouraging. Yes, it's a gift to see it, right? But it's also important to teach people how to develop that muscle. People managers have to develop an atrophied muscle that frankly doesn't lend itself to embracing people who are innovators. We actually run away from them because I just want to get what I have before me done.
Yes, I understand. So do you recall any cultural issues that the club tackled that you're exceptionally proud of?
Well, so let me tell you something. It's really interesting. Those who know Barry Diller or know of Barry Diller's reputation, he's a really tough businessman. He's gnarly, and I sent him a note the other day, and he says, "Oh, Johnny," I said, "you're gruff and rough, right?" And one of the things that we struggled with, this is an interesting innovation. So I said to employees, listen, we have some big turnover, and we're getting people in here, and they're saying, you know, I don't quite like it. This is a tough environment, and people work hard. They are very blunt, very direct. The culture there was not, we don't dress things up. You say what you have to say, and you get it on the table, and then you're expected to go back to work. And so the culture in our sitting around the culture club, a lot of times this is, you know, we really have to work on this. And I remember this epiphany. One guy, and I wish I could remember his name, he said, or do we? Is the problem that we are recruiting the wrong people? He said, listen, this is what it is. Barry is an incredibly successful businessman, billionaire, good human. He just isn't nice and cuddly and soft and feel like that's not what you're going to get out of him. And so why are we recruiting people who want that? That's our problem. We're trying to be everything to everyone, and it's a bad idea. We should spend more time looking for people. We want diversity, but diversity within a context of people who feel comfortable working in this type of culture. And so the real innovation there was we began to specifically and bluntly articulate our culture. And we would say to people during the process, there are two things we're going to judge you for, the recruitment and talent acquisition process. We're going to recruit for technical competency, and we want you to be really good, but we're also and equally going to assess you for cultural alignment. Back then we said fit, and of course all of the law firms were having a fit. They didn't like the term cultural fit because that was a code for other things. So we said cultural alignment, and we literally would say no matter how brilliant of a programmer or a scientific algorithm person this is, if they are not aligned with this culture, if someone says during the interview, listen, I'm here for, this is a phrase of mine, that work-life balance. We were not an organization that was even remotely interested in the idea of work-life balance. It's for you to figure out. Now, what we said was we embrace work-life integration, and that is you figure out how to make this all work, and we'll make sure that we provide appropriate accommodations and things like that. But it's you'll never have balance in work. So why would you recruit someone who, through the process, no matter how talented they were, who spent half the time talking about work-life balance? They will not be happy here. And that was a big innovation that came out of the Culture Club, to be honest. And it helped transform not only our recruitment, but our retention numbers, because we stopped bringing people in who wanted something else out of the employer than we were ever going to provide them.
Interesting. Yeah, we changed the language to work-life harmony.
I like that. Yeah. Yeah. And those are the, and we're evolving, but it really is a big point. I can't tell you whenever I sit down, when, you know, even now we're all in the middle of post-pandemic talking about a reset. You know, when I talk to someone who says, you know, I can do my work from anywhere, I'm like, well, that means you're not going to make it here, because we believe that there's something special that happens in the workplace when human beings get together. They ideate, they challenge each other. This is what happens. And while you don't have to do it 5 days a week, 3-4 days a week, we're going to do that. And if this doesn't work for you, got it, check. But there's no point in recruiting you because you're really, really talented and the best person in the world, we think, of doing this. And then you get here and you're unhappy. I mean, what's the point of that?
Absolutely. Well, I want to let you know when I became the president of the Johnny Taylor Jr. Fan Club was in 2019 when you spoke at the annual Conscious Capitalism conference that was here in Phoenix. And you spoke on hiring the formerly incarcerated. Yes. And it was later that evening that we heard stories from several formerly incarcerated women. In July, you wrote a piece in USA Today with the headline, "How should I approach hiring a candidate with a criminal record?" I'd like to have you talk to us about currently, what is it like for somebody with a criminal record to apply for a job?
It's tough. It's really tough. I'm actually working with someone right now who'll be released from prison. He is in Utah right now. And let me tell you, the trepidation, particularly for people who have been incarcerated for long periods of time, the things that we take for granted, that there are people who went into prison before there were cell phones. right? The world has changed so much. So really, when I talk to these folks, sometimes they say, I'm not so sure I want to be released because the world has so changed in 20, 30 years. Now, I know that's something unfathomable for the rest of us, but that there's a fear with all of the change that has occurred. But then the stigma, right? The stigma of having to explain what you did, notwithstanding the fact that you've served your time, but having to constantly deal with the stigma and the attendant rejection. All of those things are very, when we talk about stressors, that's a heck of a stressor. So the person gets out. If they're lucky, they have family members who will help them get back into the world, but they need housing. Then you need transportation and you need a job. And let me tell you, there's as much as we all talk about it, we've had to really work hard to get people over their refusal, outright refusal, their bias toward people who've made mistakes and require second chances. So what's scaring them is that all of these people say they're going to give me a second chance, but in practice, I'm not sure that they will. So that's what I get. It's an overall sense of anxiety and fear at all times. And then for that one or two, that person who does, I was just talking to someone the other day who's been released now about a year. They said, and now I'm fearful that someone will find out that I was formerly incarcerated. So the HR department and the hiring manager was willing to give me the chance. Those two were willing to give me a chance. But what if my colleague finds out? Will I be fired? Will I be rejected again? So there's just this constant living in fear, which is why all of my work and Sherm's work and now I know your work is about destigmatizing it. People make mistakes. And some of those mistakes result in them being incarcerated. And once they've served their time, we have to not resentence them every day for the rest of their lives.
So there's a pretty high percentage. I was surprised, you know, that it says research has shown that 85% of people report a willingness to work with somebody who has a conviction. Are you seeing those numbers change over time? And, you know, how is that really affecting those folks with a criminal record to find in finding work?
So to be honest, and this is where my work is not done yet, people say one thing but do something else. What we're finding when you really, no surprise, right? Human beings, right? So what we're hearing is people say that, but there are two problems. One, what they really mean is to work with you, not with me. So sure, I'm fine with my company hiring someone who's been formerly incarcerated as long as they're not in my department or working with my daughter or my wife, right? So that's part is the NIMBY concept, not in my backyard. And we're seeing that, and that's a concern. The other issue is that we have a bias toward low-level crimes. So if someone wrote a bad check or was arrested for, you know, something that we deem an acceptable crime, then we're okay with it. When you dig down and start asking, and we're doing some research in this regard at Sherm right now, we say, okay, let's ratchet it up. Sure, the person went to jail for writing a bad check, fraud or forgery, got it. Maybe you won't put them in your finance department. But what if it were child abuse? What if it were sexual assault? What if it were murder? And the person is fully, are you willing? And let me tell you that 85% comes down precipitously, right down to the low 20s when you start ramping up what the all of the universe of types of crimes. And so we've got to overcome that. And I just gave a talk today here in Arkansas, another A city, but in Arkansas. And we were talking about that. And I said, listen, if you commit yourself to giving the formerly incarcerated a chance, a second chance, then this cannot be limited by your own bias toward what are real crimes and what are not real crimes. Because the 700,000 people coming out of prison every day in the United States, they run the gamut in terms of the types of crimes they've committed.
Yeah, and I mean, companies really need to broaden that pool of candidates. And it just seems like not only formerly incarcerated, but you know, our aging workforce, our disabled workers. I mean, we have a wealth of talent out there. We've just got to figure out how to tap into that and assimilate them. And I think then it causes a whole nother conversation about how do we, as supervisors and managers, learn how to lead and motivate those individuals too. So that'll be another podcast, Johnny.
Well, let me just tell you real quick, it's D&I. The diversity is getting them in. The inclusion is making sure, to your point, that they're assimilated and they feel like they belong. Yes, big discussion. I'd love to talk later about D, or IEND as we call it, inclusion, equity, and diversity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's big, very, very big. You know, I want to talk to you a little bit about the COVID crisis, of course, but really the reveal, the great reveal, if you will, of the important role of HR.
Yes.
And it wasn't just in the eyes of the CEOs, but it was also in employees too.
Yes.
You interface with all sorts of CEOs across our country. What did they say about HR? I mean, you know, it was always like, let's get HR at the table. They were at the head of the table during the crisis.
Well, that's what I heard. So I remember in April of last year, CEO of a big financial services company said to me, Johnny, I've had more significant and substantive conversations with my HR executive and the HR team in the last 8 weeks than I'd had in the prior 8 years. True statement. And I was in shock, one, that he was so candid about it. And he said, I'm finally understanding how critical the function is. He said, now, I always understood you needed people and you need to hire them, you had to fire them, develop them, pay them. Like, I got it. But I kind of took it for granted until the pandemic. And the pandemic shone a real light for me on how important this work is. When you couple it with the fact that we are in a knowledge-based economy, so people really do matter, notwithstanding all of the AI and machine learning and all of that, the human veneer is incredibly important still and will be increasingly more important over time. But add to that, we have a real war for talent problem because of the birth rate problem in the U.S. Americans stopped having children at the rates that they did starting in about the year 2000. So for the last two decades, we've seen a decline in the American birth rate. Last year during the pandemic, the birth rate dropped another 4%, which means we have a real problem in our hand. The sustained war for talent is a fact, is sort of our reality. It's not just going to go away with the next economic cycle downturn, right? And so that's what CEOs are saying now. I understand. The final statement that really stuck with me is a CEO said to me, Johnny, I don't have any problem accessing financial capital. The world is awash with cash for investments. He said, the problem is human capital. I can't find enough of the right people to do this work for me. So I actually have money in the bank, powder in the keg, and I can't shoot.
It's really crazy, I know. So I'm also involved in the 50-50 Women on Boards initiative to drive gender balance and diversity on corporate boards. And a couple of years ago when I was chairing the event here in Phoenix, it was 2019, there was a woman that sits on the board for a major bank, and I got the last question in because I was in charge. And my question to her was, are you seeing boards be more open to other functional expertise, including human resources on boards? It was so deflating when she told me no. She says, I think it's going to be a long time before we start seeing an outreach for HR professionals on corporate boards. Again, you're talking to these CEOs. I'm guessing that they're saying to you, hey, I'm looking to add some folks to my board. Are they coming to you for HR leadership? Because that, you know, again, this human capital issue and compensation, there's so many issues need to be part of the board conversation.
Let me tell you, that's just the one area where I have seen such a significant turn. You can't make it up. In 2019, I would have absolutely agreed with that woman who made the comment, because she was being honest. You know, you can't ask questions you don't want the answer to. But let me tell you, in 2021, oh my gosh, the headhunters, everyone, I must get a call a week. In fact, I just joined a board, Fortune 250 company, XPO Logistics, as the head of the comp committee, because now the organizations, now more than ever, CEOs finally got it. Boards started getting it. Remember, we now have ESG is everywhere, and boards are being held accountable, not just for the financial, you know, deliverables. The means don't, just the ends don't justify the means. People want to know how to get there. And so HR people are uniquely qualified now to speak to issues of culture. Not just, you know, we had lawyers on the board because we could deal with, if you had a sexual harassment claim or class action, the lawyers can address this. Well, now they're saying that's not okay to have people on the board who have the skills to respond to it. We need to get in front of it. So fortunately, there's a robust level of interest right now in HR professionals to join boards and to bring their expertise in identifying people, managing culture, motivating people. It's just amazing that what has happened in just under 2 years.
Well, I'm really happy to hear that. I'm starting to see a bit more of it too. I do a lot of referrals and pushing that out there. So what advice do you have to HR leaders who are interested in beginning their board search?
Yeah, so one, you've got to be really, really good at HR. Mm-hmm. And I know that may sound really obvious, but what do I mean by that? When I get a call, and this has happened over the years, and I'm as guilty as any, so let me tell you in that context. I'd get a call from someone randomly about my interest in serving on a board. My preparation for that call was reading all of their financial documents, all of their investor reports, et cetera, so that I could prove that I was literally as smart as, and as at least as smart as their finance person, right? And I understood their financial situations, et cetera, so that I could make the case that I will be additive to the board. The mistake that I was making is when someone calls you and you have an HR background, it's because they know you have an HR background. So you should spend your time making the case that the value you're going to bring to the table is not that of a CFO. They have finance people around the table. They need what you do best, which is understanding of people and culture, right? And compensation and those sorts of things, what motivates and demotivates people. And so I would say that immediately to anyone listening, that when you get the call, do not preoccupy yourself, because we're tempted to do it, to make the case that you understand business. Sure, you should know something about how the company makes money or doesn't, right? You should understand their products, but you should really spend your time making sure that you really can articulate the value of you going on the board as a people expert.
Amen. Okay, so you have a really fascinating background too, non-traditional as a recruiter,
yes.
non-traditional background that would not, in my guesstimation, end up running a membership professional organization.
That's right.
And you are really killing it in our space. So thank you for that. But who are your role models or mentors, and how did they influence you as a leader?
Three, and I can rattle them off that quickly. One, it was Jack Welch. And it was because he really, really didn't just talk about the importance of HR and the importance of people, developing them, et cetera. He lived it. This was the CEO who said, on my right hand is the CHRO, the left hand is the CFO, and those two people, I literally don't make decisions without them. So he's a mentor in that sign. He also literally, I worked with him before he died when I was at IEC. He was an advisor to our board and therefore me. Secondly, Wayne Huizenga, an entrepreneur who created three Fortune 500 companies. Most, the one that you know mostly is Blockbuster, right? Mm-hmm. The creator of Blockbuster and founder of the Blockbuster brand. And I, because he was such an innovator. And guess what? He didn't have a college degree. So he was one of the people who I first learned that smart doesn't necessarily show up in a newly minted MBA from Harvard. Like, this smart people show up in the darndest places and can be amazing transformers in our communities and in our business world. So that was my second one. And then the third person is someone who you know of course, is Thurgood Marshall. Mm-hmm. Thurgood Marshall absolutely stands out, on top because of his willingness. I'm a lawyer, right? To use his what he knew well to create opportunities for all people. And it didn't just stop at Black people. It was for every women right now benefit because of the presence of a Thurgood Marshall on the U.S. Supreme Court. So those three people, the person who's totally committed to, industry, the person who and was an innovator, the person who was totally committed to HR, and the person who ensured that everyone had equal opportunity, not to be confused with equal outcomes, but equal opportunity. And those are my three who really have informed mostly how I got. Now, I have a ton of people who've influenced me, but those are the big three.
Well, it explains a lot about your DNA and your makeup there, Johnny. Well, before I let you go, my last question for you is, what's the most important first step CEOs can take to reset their organizations today?
Oh, I love this question. Number one, in fact, rarely do I like superlatives like the best, the most, whatever. But every CEO, or frankly, even if you're just running a part of a business or a department, you've got to sit down, Mr. or Ms. CEO, and decide what your culture is. It is long gone are the days where you can sit down and put five or six fancy sentences on a plaque and say, this is our culture, this is what we stand for, because employees aren't going for it anymore. Prospective employees are going to test you. They're going to challenge you. They want you to live the culture that you represent to them during the process, the hiring process. And that's where it all breaks down. When you see organizations that are struggling with their people and their culture, it's because the organization has not taken the time, the intentionality, put the discipline that we put into everything else we do to sit down and say, what actually is our culture? Yes, you can talk about what you aspire for it to be, but if you're going to recruit people into your organization, you best be sure that you are making a total and sort of an accurate representation of who you are, so that when they get there, what you said during the recruitment process isn't significantly different from what they're going to experience when they actually show up, their lived experience at your workplace. So I would tell every CEO listening, you've got to sit down and put the effort into working with your executive team and then cascading it out throughout your organization. Be honest about who you are. There's no such thing as a good or a bad culture. Of course, I'm going to, you know, save the unethical, illegal, immoral. I'm not talking about those things, but putting that aside, what works in one organization may not work in another organization. You just got to be true to it.
Well, I have to tell you, that was a turning point for me as the CEO of my company, is to be true to mine. And I used to think that I needed to be rough and tumble, and I didn't think that I was I fit the traditional profile of a CEO. And when I realized it was okay to be kind and gentle, and that's the culture that I have over here, it's made a world of difference. So, thank you. Well, Johnny, thanks so much for joining me today. It's been fantastic chatting with you and learning more, and continue to be the president of your fan club over here.
I need it. Thank you.
and again, congratulations on the book and your continued success. And thank you for all that you're doing for all of us in the HR profession.
Well, thank you for everything that you're doing, because I get to be the face of it, but it's the work that you all do every day. I can't go out and make the case that HR matters if HR practitioners like you don't deliver great HR. So thank you too, and God bless you all. And thanks again for giving me this opportunity today.
You're very welcome. He is Johnny Taylor Jr., the president and CEO of the Society of Human Resource Management, and the author of the fantastic new book, Reset, A Leader's Guide to Work in an Age of Upheaval. And that's it for this special edition of Revolutionizing Recruitment. I hope you enjoyed the show. And if you did, make sure you take a second to subscribe so you automatically get my new shows when they drop. Also, if you have a minute, I'd love if you left us a review so more folks like yourself can discover the show. Until next time, take care.
This has been Revolutionizing Recruitment with Kathleen Duffy. To connect with Kathleen or to learn more about recruitment research, go to duffygroup.com.